Good morning. I'm Andrea B., and I'm a recovering alcoholic. I love that sound. I'm going to ask that we take a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. I have the distinct pleasure today to work with three very important individuals to the alcoholism field. I'm going to give you brief introductions of them in turn, and then they will come to the podium, flesh out their bios just a little bit more to put what they're going to say in context. They'll give their speeches, and when we have concluded, we'll have an opportunity to ask questions of them or make comments. If you're making comments, please keep them brief or try to find the question in them. And the microphone is in the center aisle. Our first speaker will be Dr. Charles Schwartz. He is an internist, a psychiatrist, and the associate professor of medicine, family medicine, and psychiatry at Albert Einstein in New York. Our second speaker will be Sue Shuttle. Shuttle. She told me it was just like shuttle, and I wrote it wrong. No. She's a social worker. She is the program director of the Alcohol and Drug Program at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. And Corliss Burke, who in addition to being a Class A trustee, has been in the addiction field for 26 years. She lives in Whitehorse, Yukon. She went there. Our crowd is awake today, or at least they are now. She went there to be the Deputy Minister of Health. And she's retired now and has a consulting practice, which all of her experiences, as all of our experiences do, will inform what she has to say. I wanted to say just a brief comment before starting. I'm Andrea B., and I'm an alcoholic. And as a child, I was not well tended. And I needed to be loved. And because I wasn't loved, I found love in a bottle. And when I got sober, it was after sitting with a therapist for a long period of time who decided that she needed to love me until I loved myself. There are lots of methods that people use to help people get into these meetings of AA, and hers was one. It was the one that worked for me. And so the comment that I want to make before we start hearing from my esteemed colleagues here to the left is that they're going to talk about their experiences in the alcoholism field, and I'm sure that we'll leave here knowing that no one size fits all, and the good therapist is one who finds what works for you. And my therapist loved me until I could go into AA. And I'm glad that I didn't exhaust her love because there was an unlimited amount of it in rooms like this with people like you. And I was glad she had enough to get me there. So let's hear from Dr. Schwartz.
Hi, I'm Charlie Schwartz. I'm not an alcoholic. And actually, as I thought about coming here, that was about as far as I got, and then I was kind of puzzled about what was supposed to come after. Anyway, but then I spoke to some people and got some ideas. Anyway, but I am a friend, and I'm a staunch believer in AA. I'm a doctor. I'm both an internist and a psychiatrist, and I've spent my career at Montefiore Hospital, Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, teaching medical students, interns, and residents how to become doctors. It's been wonderful to be an academic over the last 25 years because it's really suited me. I've been able to be like a wide-eyed kid in the candy store of ideas, going wherever my restless curiosity, and I have a lot of restlessness and a lot of curiosity, has taken me. I trained in internal medicine in Greenwich Village at the dawn of the AIDS epidemic, and I've always been an HIV doctor. I have dabbled in the twilight zone of interconnection between mind and body called psychosomatic medicine. I've also become a palliative care and end-of-life doc and a bioethicist, especially concerned with ensuring high-quality medical care for disadvantaged and stigmatized patient populations, most particularly those with chronic mental illness, alcoholism, and addiction. And I have become a physician who trains future physicians to work with alcoholics and addicts. It's really an honor to be here with all of you. This has been an amazing experience. And I want to thank you especially for the opportunity you've given me to reflect on my journey, kind of all that I've learned from AA, and some things, actually, that I've learned as a doctor that's in the minority, and spending considerable time, although I always have, my wife tells me, you know, don't tell them about AA because you know nothing. I think I've spent considerable time on step 4 in thinking about some of my shortcomings. with respect to this. I can't remember my first drink. I think that probably distinguishes me from most other people here. All that comes to mind is how terrible it tasted, and how terrible it still tastes. As an adult, I do try to be sociable. If I'm out with friends and they're having a drink before dinner, I might order a strawberry daiquiri. But when it comes, I secretly wish it was actually a virgin daiquiri. I'm just a child who's never grown up. I only like sweet things, but I'm trying to do what I can to pass as an adult. My wife likes a bit of scotch, and we'd go out to dinner and get the scotch and the strawberry daiquiri, and they always brought me the scotch. And I said, oh, no. I'm the daiquiri. So I don't drink or use drugs. I haven't made any choice about that. It's not some virtuous decision or moral thing or whatever. It's just the way I came out. It's taken years, but I finally understand that people who are alcoholics, I believe, although I say this with humility, are born that way, and that I just didn't happen to be born with that kind of genetic vulnerability. In a wonderful Scandinavian study, they followed children who were adopted and they followed them into adulthood. Now, some of these children, it turned out when they looked, had been born of alcoholic parents. Some had not. And some, unfortunately, were adopted into families of alcoholics, and some were not. And the fascinating thing is it turned out that those children born of alcoholics were virtually the only ones who grew up to become alcoholics themselves in some percentage. And that it didn't really matter that much if their adoptive parents had been alcoholics or not. So it seems like maybe nature wins over nurture here a little bit. As I said, I do have a personal weakness. My weakness is sweets. At the end of my first year of medical school, I stayed to work in a lab while my roommates left for the summer, and one night I got kind of hungry and was rummaging through the kitchen. I hit gold when I opened the freezer and I saw a beautiful tray of homemade brownies. I think I could skip the rest of the story. What a find. One of my guys had left me a wonderful gift, and I ate one, and, you know, because this is my kind of secret addiction, once I ate one, I couldn't stop till they were all gone. And then I drove over to a classmate's apartment, and all of a sudden, I felt very strange. A little woozy. It was kind of a little pleasant, but it really scared me because I don't like to be out of control. And I was kind of sitting there kind of, I guess, with a big grin on my face, but kind of quaking. And then it dawned on me what this was. It was the brownies. They were sweet and chocolate. That's basically my criteria for heaven. But now that I thought about it, they were a little gritty, a little grainy. There was that hint of vegetable fiber in there. I guess when I've heard stories, you know, it's sort of like how that first drink doesn't taste good and people can get sick and all that, but that makes no difference. So for me, you know, that this actually didn't taste all that good made a little difference to me. So my friends took me by the hands, drove me home, and I slept it off. But it had been quite a whopping dose, so I was actually, for the next 48 hours, I was actually still high on hash. That was my one and only experience with hash because, alas, I'm not constituted to tune into these things. As a young child growing up, I was blissfully ignorant and innocent, and I never met anybody who had a problem with alcohol or drugs. That was at least what I told myself. Well, there was that month when a bottle of rye appeared on our kitchen counter and looked emptier every morning. That was the month my father was very depressed. But in a matter of weeks, his depression seemed to ease, the bottle disappeared, and nobody ever spoke about that again. From my current perspective, I don't think my father was actually an alcoholic, though I don't know for sure because my mother kept secrets about so many things in the family and everything had to be just so I actually don't know for sure. But my best guess is that he was, and I say this very advisedly, self-medicating, because my father was clearly somebody who would never acknowledge any emotional difficulties and would certainly never see a shrink. My parents had a lot of trouble with figuring out what kind of doctor I was. I kept them guessing. But there was this shrink in there somewhere, which they tried to avoid. Now, I actually hate the term self-medication. Research has shown that in the vast majority of cases, alcohol actually causes depression, and that very few people actually simply drink because they're depressed. In wonderful studies on alcoholic veterans going into 28-day VA detoxes, that's when we used to have 28-day detoxes as opposed to 30-second revolving door detoxes, almost half of those folks looked like they were pretty deeply depressed on the way into the detox. These usual detox, Librium and, you know. When they emerged 28 days later, turned out only about 1 in 15 looked depressed. So what that amounts to is that 85 to 90% of all depression that I see in people who are actively drinking is purely driven by the alcohol. So I don't treat people for depression if they're actively drinking or drugging, because it makes really no sense based on the evidence. Growing up, there was also my uncle, a corporate executive, who terrorized his family. I still get nervous when I remember visits to my cousins as a kid, hearing him bellow down at my poor aunt from the second floor bedroom, always furious about something that he claimed had not been done. But far stronger than my fear was the relief I felt every time we left. Unfortunately, my poor cousins had to stay, but I had the fortune to be able to go home. I now know that my uncle was an alcoholic, though I didn't find out about this until I was grown up. Thanks to AA, he's been sober for decades, and actually he's a whole lot nicer. Over the past few years, my uncle's become a dedicated sponsor for a number of people struggling to recover, and my aunt could not keep them out of the hospital room when he had his bypass surgery, and she was really tipped off. He wishes he could be here today. When I spoke to him over the phone, when I spoke to him, I could sense that he started sighing when I said I was coming here. Now, I'd say this tentatively, but I've been talking to a number of alcoholics in New York who are, you know, deeply committed members of AA. I got that reaction a lot. I almost felt like I was a Muslim coming to Mecca. I think I'm going to leave with that same feeling, too. So my childhood wasn't entirely alcohol and drug-free after all, but I remained completely clueless. So as a kid, I was really a nerd. I sat in the front row, had a plastic pocket protector in my pocket, and I was surrounded by kids just like me. So I don't really remember even anybody particularly drugging or drinking, except there was one friend named Steve who I did a lot of singing with. I do a lot of singing. But then in high school, he just seemed to drift away in a haze of drinks and drug. And he surfaced many years later, clean and sober and trying to remake a life. He was reaching out, trying to gather up the shattered pieces of his life. One of those pieces turned out to be me. But I felt really uncomfortable. I just didn't know what to do or say, and I'm really not proud of this. And I can only hope that, Steve, that you found your way, because I sure didn't help. In college, I sang in a small a cappella group, but I dropped out after spring break when my group sang and drank its way down from New Haven, Connecticut to Florida and back. I loved the singing, but I just couldn't understand why they loved to get bombed every night with those old alums in a succession of fancy country clubs down the East Coast. Well, I just stood painfully at the periphery. Recently, I've actually been thinking a lot about what happens to kids who drink heavily in college. Their drinking seems to be pretty much the same. Many of them look kind of alike while they're doing that. But some leave college facing lifelong alcohol and drug problems, while most seem to emerge unscathed. As I said, in my view, it's predominantly those who are genetically vulnerable, those who have alcoholic parents, siblings, and close relatives, who are at risk to leave college in big trouble. But I've been thinking about college drinking, unfortunately, for another reason, because 2 years ago, I learned there's more to alcohol than alcoholism. I really hadn't given that much thought, but alcohol can not only addict and slowly and progressively destroy, it can suddenly kill people. Matt, my med school roommate's son, who grew up with my daughters, he wasn't an alcoholic, and no one in his family is, so he probably wasn't destined to become one, though we'll never know. Under unclear circumstances, he drank very heavily, maybe in a drinking contest, with some kids at the end of his dorm at the end of his freshman year at Northwestern. And when he passed out, they did what kids do. They carried him to his bed to, as we all say, or many people say, sleep it off. But Matt wasn't sleeping. He was slipping deeper and deeper into an alcohol-induced coma. He hadn't had the good sense to vomit like some of the other people in the room with him. And sometime during that night, he stopped breathing and was found dead in his bed in the morning. Kids don't know how to recognize danger. They think that the friends they should worry about are those who are loud, emotional, agitated, or get sick and vomit. But that's dead wrong. It's the kids who are quietly sleeping it off whose sleep can become eternal. But the kids don't know this. No one's teaching them. In fact, most adults don't know that either. And, mea culpa, I'm ashamed to admit that I was pretty much as ignorant as everybody else. The only difference is I had no right to be, because I'm a doctor and actually know better. I just had never really given it much thought until poor Matt died. So when I went to medical school over 30 years ago, they didn't teach us much about alcohol, just about medical diseases that it caused, like cirrhosis. And whatever passing reference they made to alcoholism dripped with disapproval. No one ever taught me how to ask about drinking. No one ever told me how to ask patients about sex either. Unfortunately, none of this has really changed. But my training in clinical medicine actually began with alcohol. Anna was my first patient on the medical wards as I began my third year, and I'll never forget her. She was a 40-year-old elementary school teacher hospitalized with cirrhosis and a rapidly expanding fluid-filled belly. I can still see her now, that first day when I met her. Those big brown eyes, her gentle words that eased me, a young, wet-behind-the-ears medical student, into physicianhood. She told me how much she loved teaching. Of course, like you all, she was already teaching me. And how she's going to get back to the classroom as soon as she got better. But as the days passed, I watched helplessly as her irreparably damaged liver failed, and within a couple of days, her eyes became vacant. We had no more talks, and about a week later, she died. After my resident formally pronounced her dead, that's kind of this ridiculous ritual that doctors do, because people are dead. It's not like pronouncing people man and wife. But in any case, after he pronounced her dead and everybody left the room, I stayed behind and I closed the door. I was in shock and I was very depressed. But all of a sudden I got very angry. Why did Anna have to die? Why couldn't I do anything about it? But then that all changed. Suddenly I was furious at her. I remember yelling at her. I actually pounded on the bed around her body. Anna, this is your fault. Why did you do this to yourself? And with the developing hubris of the physician, why did you do this to me? I was puzzled by my reaction, but later on I learned when I actually studied psychiatry that this awful turning on our patients when we have failed them is called blaming the victim. Anna taught me that women are a lot more vulnerable to the ravages of alcohol and often succumb to medical consequences decades before male alcoholics do. But somehow I never thought about finding out more about alcoholism or how I might help people to head off tragic outcomes like hers, and nobody ever taught me, not in med school, not in my internal medicine training, and not in my psychiatry training. I'd actually come to school, med school, to become a psychiatrist, to understand brain behavior, learn how people change, but I was completely turned off by my psychiatry clerkship. The patients hospitalized at the old venerated Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut seemed to stay forever, and none of them seemed to get any better. So I left disillusioned, and I decided not to do that. I decided to become a real doctor. So internal medicine, now this was a field where I'd get a handle on tangible diseases and like medical treatments. As an intern, I gave sedatives for DTs, and I loved to suture up the bleeding heads of Bowery alcoholics in the ER. By the way, I don't know how recently anybody's been to New York, but there ain't no more Bowery. There is a Bowery. It's a place I can't afford to live, but that's it. And then I would just send them on their way when they sobered up. And in the depths of winter, we warmed up those brought in from the streets who were unconscious and nearly frozen. And I have to tell you something else that I'm really not proud of. Me, like all doctors, sometimes would laugh at my patients at their expense behind their backs. Maybe it serves to relieve our tension, allows us to go on, but it's incredibly disrespectful and haughty. All right, let me get to the point here, cut to the chase. We actually called our hypothermic alcoholics momsicles or popsicles, depending on gender. I actually only learned about alcohol and how people change after my residencies and all that when I started to teach people. I went to my very first AA meeting as a faculty member, and I took taking medical students to AA. I didn't know anything about it, but I felt that it was important for them, and I wanted to learn about that. I wanted to learn about it too. I did a lot of taking people to places I'd never been. I decided to bypass the South Bronx, and I took him to a meeting in a church basement on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. The room was filled with young men and women in suits carrying briefcases, and I watched with amusement as my students looked around furtively, nervously seeing if they actually recognized anybody. I found it incredibly compelling when one of the suits got up and told his story. His name was John. He told us how he drank his way through college, but when I graduated, the party never stopped. He drank more and more, began snorting coke, and within 6 months, he was on the streets. I was a privileged kid, a drunk with no skills. I didn't even know how to be homeless. The winter finally drove him to a shelter, then to a rehab, and then to AA. He told us that he was coming up on his fourth anniversary. He had gone back to school, got his MBA, was working downtown, thus the suit. I'm blessed that I was able to figure things out and turn it around so quickly. A meeting every day is what keeps me sober, at least so far, he said. As I listened with my students from our perch way in the back, I watched heads nod throughout the hall as the story resonated and hit home, and I found myself joining in the celebration of anniversaries, of hard-won victories. Bill W. described this amazing process. We seem to get a life out of hearing personal stories and interpretations of other members, but we can't always explain why. Stranger than that, I felt welcomed in your community. Me, the non-alcoholic, who didn't even understand why anybody would drink stuff that tasted so bad. So it began. I came back every 6 weeks, the new group of students. I really wanted to understand something about this fellowship, and I kind of wanted to join. Occasionally, I'd say to my wife, it's too bad I'm not an alcoholic. So AA was what taught me something about how people can change and how stupid doctors can be. We spend almost all of our time training in the hospital. We rapidly diagnose desperately ill patients. We tell them what's wrong with them. We tell them what the treatment is. And then we do this remarkable thing. We waltz out of the room, go to the nurse's station, and write to the orders as if we're a general, you know, giving the nurses and the patients the marching orders. Well, that kind of works in the hospital. If it doesn't work, they usually call a psychiatrist. But it doesn't work outside the hospital. Bill W. actually said that medicine brought a special gift to alcoholism. It's called the medical model of alcoholism. So he says the emphasis was shifted from sin to sickness. The fatal malady was alcoholism, more lethal than cancer, an obsession of the mind coupled with increasing body sensitivity. However, as far as I'm concerned, that's about the only contribution medicine's ever made to the whole affair. He had brilliant insights. He actually wrote the book on behavior change, you know, decades and decades before. Now other people are really interested in behavior change, but Bill W. had it all. Paradoxically, of course you know this, but so knowledge to me, it was only by recognizing his powerlessness over alcohol and turning to God in fellowship that he actually found the power to do what he had to do. Now, interestingly, what Bill W. found is not just about alcoholism, because medicine is facing a scourge of public health diseases whose answer is this, and it isn't some pill and so on and so forth. So obesity, diabetes, heart disease, even HIV in terms of its infectivity. This is all about hearts, minds, and behavior, which, frankly, doctors don't know anything about. A decade ago, I went down to Hazleton in West Palm Beach for a faculty training program. By this time, in my physicianly humility, I felt that no one could teach me anything. I could give all the conferences. Boy, was I wrong. For a week, I had the privilege of sitting with a group of alcoholics coming for aftercare every evening. Now, my mentor was Frank, a short, stocky, sandy-haired man in his 40s who came every night with those riveting blue eyes and his jaw set with determination. He was a contractor who nearly lost everything, his wife, his kids, his livelihood. He had brought his heavy drinking with him to construction, and it seemed to work. He signed up customers over those lunches that were oiled by alcohol, and he finished every day by drinking with the crew. But things got kind of bad at home, he said, and he said no more about that. Looked away from me, but on the third day, he told me that what the real story was, that she was yelling at me about my drinking and how late it was, and I guess I just snapped. I hit her in the face. The next morning, I didn't remember, I didn't know, I didn't want to know, but then she looked right at me with that black eye. You know, I never hit anybody in my whole life. I was so ashamed and scared I was going to lose my family, so I came to Hazleton. Frank taught me the power of AA in a profoundly personal way. Night by night, I watched him in another struggle toward recovery with the help of several people, like a few steps ahead of him, kindred spirits who really understood and could point the way. I learned about the power of fellowship and about the power of mentors and sponsors. I left Hazleton with all of that, plus as a physician, I left with one magic sentence that I never knew before. As your doctor, I have to tell you that I am concerned about your drinking. No confrontation, no criticism, humility, respect, and professional concern. So let me just finish up by saying, so I came back from Hazleton, and I tried to, you know, carry that message, and I spend some of my time, I spend time in 4,000 places in my restlessness, but some of my time as the psychiatric director of a program in New York that I heard mentioned yesterday called PAT, the Physicians Alcohol and Addiction Training Program, is run by a doc named Nick Pace and a co-director named Bill Ciccaroni. The basic methodology is pairing them with a buddy, somebody who can actually mentor them and teach them like I was taught. So we are doing stuff like screening, or at least that's the national recommendation. People are thinking about what decent questions might be to screen somebody in the office. They've defined what they call high-risk drinking, which is very helpful to me because if I use myself as a norm, everybody's crazy. But, I don't know what to make out of any kind of quantity, like what's a normal quantity. So I think medicine is making some advances, but it's very slow and painful. And we all need a sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Schwartz. I'm always in awe when I meet a doctor who has come to learn that he doesn't know it all. And I haven't met a lot in my life, but I meet most of them in addiction medicine and recognizing the value of sponsorship. So it's awesome. We're going to go on to the next speaker. Sue Shuttle, the Space Shuttle, is going to share some of her experiences with us in working with a military population and beyond.
Good morning. What an awesome weekend. Oh, my gosh. So excited to be here. Yes, I have been honored with this idea. I am Sue Shettle, and I am a friend of AA, and just overwhelmed. This wide-eyed image that you got from Dr. Schwartz has kind of impressed me as what I've been trying to learn this entire weekend. So thank you. Hi. Give yourselves a hand. Look at where we have come and where you have come in building AA and making it just amazing and overwhelming. So fantastic. I started working at Andrews Air Force Base 18 years ago, kind of by accident in the alcohol and drug field. As a social worker, I worked with a number of populations. Clearly, alcohol and drug issues were a thread through that, but this was not emphasized in my schooling. It was not emphasized in my life. I had alcoholics in my family that I never thought about, never really got concerned about. They just drank a lot, and all of their consequences seemed to be kind of their business, not mine. And so when I got the job at Andrews Air Force Base, I came into it wanting to help others, wanting to watch people change. But the focus of how this would evolve for me was really a surprise and a gift to me. And I have stayed there because of the joy of learning from people in recovery what it's like to get their life back and make that the positive outcome that they have. So starting at Andrews Air Force Base, the job that we have a number of individuals who get in trouble. We have a number of individuals, most of whom I see, young, eager to drink, badge of honor, how much they can drink. You've kind of heard, I'm sure you've heard all the stories. And my job was really to start to triage and figure out which ones of those we could, quote, educate and help them understand some of the risks, some of the things that Dr. Schwartz has talked about. And that's a big part of what we do in the military. We have a number of individuals who become clients because of an event, because of a DUI, because of something scary that happens. Along with that, we also have lots of individuals who are on their way. And so to try and help people make change before they hit that bottom is a real challenge. I mean, you know, people don't always, I mean, you may have noticed, people don't always want to go to the AA meetings. Look at what you have to offer, and they just say, I don't want to do that. That feels squirrely. People don't want to come and see me. I don't understand. You know, they get sent to the alcohol and drug program, they say, I don't need to be here. And so that's the very first choice and the very first set of questions. And how to help people move through changes in their life for the better when in this disease, you guys know how to control your life, right? You know what's best for you from day one. So why would a therapist and why would a meeting help? And those are the kinds of questions that we dance with. When I thought about coming here today, I borrowed a phrase from the kind of therapy that I am most specialized in, and that's motivation for change, and that's dancing versus wrestling. And a number of times when I'm sitting with an individual, I'm trying to stay in that dance of starting where the client is, figuring out how much I have to back up and give them time and space and understanding and love, hopefully, and compassion, and when I need to push and dance and sort of take the lead in that dance. Now, if it doesn't work very well, then I'm wrestling. I'm saying, no, you have to go to AA, and we're going to sign you up for a treatment program, and this is going to all help you. Well, you may know that probably doesn't help very much at all. In the military, we have leverage. We say, this is in your best behalf, but by the way, if you don't go to an AA meeting, your job is going to really be a lot different, and you're going to be picking weeds at Andrews Air Force Base. So balancing, having that opportunity to get people to go and participate. And so when you see the people in the back of the rooms that are there to get their little piece of paper signed, and they're miserable, and they're glazed over, and so they're not hearing anything that you're trying to say, behind them is a miserable, unappreciated therapist that said, you're supposed to go and get something out of this. So my training, starting with this kind of particular job, started when I became involved as a facilitator in the aftercare group. We would get people in at the time, 28 days, you know, 4 days in pajamas for detox, 28 days of treatment, and you're supposed to be fixed. Go to aftercare, go to AA. We didn't know what that meant. So I would participate and co-facilitate aftercare groups, and the people who were involved in AA were the people who had this joy, this spirit, the ability to come in and make sense and grow and have the kind of life that they were looking for. And that's when I started to realize that I was home in the field of substance abuse treatment because I could participate and assist in that process. So I am thrilled with this opportunity to be here, because what I didn't realize is how open and receptive the AA community is to partnering with therapists and helping professionals. Working in the military, you know, we have that, again, that advantage. People have to come to us. Sometimes we get to see them at a time long before they're willing to go into the doors of AA on their own. So we are part of the process of helping people get in the door. Getting in the door isn't the answer, though. It's the beginning. And so to have all of you supporting the process of people who need therapy, people also who have early alcoholism, as well as the ones who are in the throes of it but still struggling with all of those reasons why people don't want to go. Being here and thinking about myself as one of the most introverted people that I've ever met, and talking to some of my clients who say, you know, I can't talk in a group. I don't want to be in a group of people. I don't know those folks. So the amazing process of watching people change is my business and also your business, and helping and offering and being available. And you do it better than any other group that I know of. And so I'm totally impressed, and I'm impressed that we can work together. So when I think of the dance of my job, of sometimes pushing, sometimes arm wrestling somebody into an AA meeting, but hopefully looking for, as I believe one of the social workers in the session yesterday said, you know, assisting them to say, what can you find in this meeting that you can relate to and that you can take with you? This is for you. Figure out what works for you. And then being available to kind of catch that response, which sometimes is very positive and sometimes not, and then kind of guide them back into the rooms, because the recovery happens in the rooms. What happens in my office has much more to do with understanding and working on some of the other dynamics going on, and also trying to field some of the resistance, some of that feeling that AA is not for me. So I can catch that reaction where sometimes they just leave and won't contact you. They come back to me and we'll say, well, let's give it another try in a different way. And then they come back and sometimes the light goes on and it's just fantastic. And then I can go to the work the next day saying, you know, this is where I want to be. This is where I can be of help. What I focus in on is motivation. And so when people are motivated to avoid consequences, okay, that's a good start. You know, a lot of our military folks, they're looking for the benefits of drinking in their day-to-day life. You know, it's really helpful in some of their peer groups to have a really high tolerance, be able to be the last one standing in the drinking game. You know, that's a badge of honor, right? I was listening to the AA and the military speakers yesterday and talking about that whole culture of values of alcohol is very much a part of ego and a part of expectation and socializing. And in the military, as colleges and many, many other places, that is a huge part of what people perceive and what keeps them from doing what we know would probably make their lives a lot safer and a lot healthier and give them the opportunity to grow and change and develop. But the pressures are there. The culture's there. And in the military, that's particularly true. And also with a lot of the stresses and a lot of the young guys coming back from deployments where now they have even more reason. And trying to tell somebody that not drinking is better than drinking is going to be sometimes a long process of talking about that. So I digress. When I think about the opportunity then to learn and to participate in individuals who are at some level of willingness to come to AA, I know that my best ally is the AA group and the sobriety that's there and the wisdom that's there. Participating in the treatment opportunity is keeping people willing to come. You know, if they're willing to give it another try, then I know that we haven't given up hope. And you know that sometimes people have to go back out and they have to try it again. My hope in my position is that we can minimize the consequences because we catch them early. And so a lot of times that motivation is there. When they go to the meetings, they may not relate to some of the stories because they haven't been there yet. And that yet is a huge word. Makes it more real. So this team approach of therapy and AA, having a place for individuals who aren't comfortable in a group to come and get some of that assistance, and having the appreciation of many of you and many of the speakers this weekend talking about, yes, the therapy helped kind of get them in the door. AA is what saved their life. That's clear, and that's what I try to share with the other individuals that I train at Andrews Air Force Base and that I see in terms of how to work with this incredible disease. The only other comment that I wanted to add was balance and trying to find something that people can strive for and look for in a world where the individuals that I work with don't necessarily want balance. They want excitement. They want thrills. They, you know, they don't want their life to go smoothly. They may not share the things that I have. And so starting where people are, starting and learning about what helps people make changes in their lives, and then being able to identify with that is something that the therapy world, I think, has grown and has changed along with AA to start to understand that just because we tell people what's good for them doesn't mean they're going to do it. Education alone doesn't stop people or help people change their behavior. It's really understanding the need and having a place where people can receive what they need. And so I appreciate all of you. I appreciate being here. I'm a grateful, awestruck friend of AA, and I appreciate the time. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to add at this moment that the therapist can help someone get in the room. Being in the room, someone has to be able to experience the joy of recovery. And the therapist can get them out of the way so they can do that, but recovery has to be full of joy. And having a therapist with you to help settle down a lot of the drama that comes with early recovery and having a sponsor to help put that drama in perspective allows the person early in recovery start to experience the joy of recovery. And that's, you know, what we heard expressed here in terms of sitting with them. So, good. Corliss?
Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased and honored to be able to share a few thoughts with you about my involvement with AA throughout the years and throughout my career in the addictions field. I have to say, I can feel the love in this room. My friends from Whitehorse, you guys are the best. Tom came up and gave me the Whitehorse pin this morning. I know, just to make sure that I realize that all of my friends in AA there are thinking of me. I know that was what he was saying to me. I also feel the love from my colleagues on the board, and thank you so much for taking me by the hand and leading me throughout this last year that I've been a non-alcoholic trustee on the General Services Board. And from my friends that I met recently in April at the General Service Conference, some from Quebec and all over Canada and the United States. It's so wonderful to see you here again, and I appreciate the support that you have given me. I am very humbled by the invitation to speak at this conference, this convention, and wanted to give you an illustration of just how humble we Canadians really are. An American comedian commented during the 2010 Olympics that were held in Vancouver this year that Canadians are an ever so polite populace. After all, their slogan for the Olympics was, "Pardon me, would it trouble you if we won a medal or two?" It would? Oh, well, then never mind. Well, I was asked to tell you a little bit about my journey to AA, so here it goes. I started my career as a high school teacher. I loved the interaction with the students, and I was excited to be part of their journey towards adulthood. One of the things that began to happen, though, is that many of them were telling me about the terrible problems in their lives. These problems, as you can guess, often revolved around the drinking of their parents, the drinking of their friends, and their own drinking. At that time, barely out of university, I felt ill-prepared to deal with these issues and the onslaught of pain that these people were experiencing as a result of alcoholism. So my plan was to, after 5 years of this, to get some training in counseling, mental health, and addictions, which would enable me then to fix up the lives of these students. A fairly ambitious goal, you might say. After I completed this training, I applied for an addictions counselor position in a residential treatment center. My intention was to get some experience in working in the field and then to return to the school system where I actually could be of some use to these students who had so many problems. That plan didn't materialize because I began to attend open AA meetings and you people kind of co-opted me. I've stayed in the field of alcoholism ever since. My first impression of AA was that it was some kind of a cult. I thought it was constantly repeating the same mantras over and over again and pressuring people to join up and become members. Well, today I see things a little differently, and that is because you tolerated me. You tolerated my lack of understanding of this program, and you welcomed me and called me a friend of AA. I am so honored to be referred to that way, and I appreciate that. You helped me to understand the program by telling me your inspiring stories, by answering the many questions I had, and by demonstrating the love of this fellowship. I feel that love in every meeting I attend, and every time you say to me, thank you for your service. And let me tell you that the experiences that I've had in attending the 2000 convention in Minneapolis and the big meeting last night are highlights of my life. My involvement with AA, which began in the treatment center where I worked as a counselor, has continued ever since. And throughout the time I worked in positions of supervisor, manager, trainer of counselors, director, and later deputy minister with the Department of Health in Canada's Yukon, in charge of developing the addiction system there, I was always aware of the essential role that AA played in the recovery of the clients that I was working with. I was very fortunate in the beginning of my career to have as a mentor Leonard Blumenthal, CEO of the agency that I started working with, former chair of your General Service Board, and current trustee emeritus. Leonard is an excellent role model in that he has attended AA meetings, open AA meetings, for the last over 35 years, and during his career always encouraged his staff and managers to avail themselves of the support of this fellowship. Over the course of my career, I've been given two medallions that I wanted to talk to you about. One symbolizes the important relationship, or they both symbolize the important relationship between treatment professionals and the AA program. I received one medallion when I was a manager as a gift from the staff of the treatment center where I had been working directly with clients. This medallion is very important to me as it is a reminder of the suffering of those clients that I worked with and the role that we played in helping them to make changes in their lives. The other medallion is one that a friend of mine received from his AA group on his 15th AA birthday. He now has over 30 years sobriety, and his life continues to improve with the passing of each year in AA. These symbols demonstrate for me the tremendous power of the cooperation between the addictions community and AA, and the power of one person reaching out to another, passing on what they have found in AA. I had begun at this point to feel the difference between academic understanding and personal experience with this program. The support that our treatment center received from AA was incredible. You provided an introduction to AA on a weekly basis as clients were admitted to the center. You helped clients to chair institutional meetings. You helped to teach them how to do that. You welcomed our staff and clients to AA meetings in the community and brought the Bridging the Gap program to our center. Two AA members drove 7 hours through a snowstorm to train our staff on the Bridging the Gap program and then drove 7 hours back to their families and work the next day. This is one of the many examples, and it's so typical, of the dedication of AA members to assisting the professional community. Because of the Bridging the Gap program, clients are no longer afraid to go to AA. Through that initiative, they receive a temporary contact in AA before they leave the treatment program, and they're encouraged to get a permanent sponsor. It's been my experience that those clients who are immersed in AA prior to leaving treatment are far more comfortable with seeking out and attending AA meetings subsequent to the program. The Bridging the Gap committee service has made a tremendous difference in the rate of post-treatment participation in AA, and therefore in long-term sobriety rates. What a wonderful service to those who are still suffering and to those of us who are trying to help them. After all, treatment programs are limited, while AA is available to all of our clients for the rest of their lives. I'm reminded of the advice given to a friend of mine by his sponsor. He said, if you're going to have to hang out with alcoholics all the rest of your life, they might as well be sober ones. Through Bridging the Gap, our clients have been able to find sober alcoholics and to connect with them and experience the fellowship and love in this program. Bridging the Gap is a major contribution of AA to the addictions field. I realized very early in my career that those of us in this field could help clients get onto the road to recovery but it is AA that walks with them down that road for the rest of their lives. I'd like to relate one last little personal story about my gratitude towards this program. My husband and I have traveled many parts of the world with our work and for pleasure. We currently have a consulting business and still attend open AA meetings wherever we travel. Last year, after an AA meeting in Nairobi, Kenya, our 13-year-old grandson, who was with us and had been listening intently to all the stories, said to me, "Boy, Nana, some of those guys had a pretty rough time, but I guess this AA stuff must really work." Well, I'll always be grateful to the members of that open-air meeting in the heart of Nairobi for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us. Hearing their stories has had a significant impact on our grandson. I think he learned that alcoholism creates terrible heartache, but that with the help of AA, alcoholics can and do change their lives. What a valuable insight for a 13-year-old to have. Now, before I close, I want to get back to that issue of Canadian humility and our so-called apologetic manner. I just have to remind you that we did, in fact, win that gold medal hockey game. But we are really sorry about that. When I received the call inviting me to submit my resume for the position of Class A trustee, I thought it would be great because I had actually heard it as Class E trustee. And I thought that title really suited me. Well, my friends, it is you who are classy. You who are helping me to understand this program and who are continuing to change my life. My faith in this program is for many reasons, including the fact that it has saved the lives of so many of my friends, that without AA, I could not have done the work that I did with alcoholic clients, and that it continues to make me a better person. It's a great honor to be asked to trudge the road of happy destiny with you. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this incredible opportunity to serve the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous.
So I'm relieved. I've been spun up for the last week getting ready to come up here. You say I didn't have to do anything but be here, but I was still all spun up, and, you know, they've made it fun, and they've made it informative, and we've laughed. I mean, I've had a really good time, even though I had to sit here and do this thing. So, and now we only have about a half hour left, and I'm going to count on you to make the rest of it fun and informative by going to the mics and making your comments or asking your questions, and then I will have had a perfect beginning to this day, and I can breathe now, but thank you. You're there.
Hi. Thank you for your talks. I appreciate all of you. I have my name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
My head has been my hobby since I was about 20 years old. I had to work, you know, things like that. AA saved my life. I started out with psychoanalysis, and, you know, it kind of opened up the whole box, and I spent my time gathering myself and trying to find out who I was and what I was. I have recently got a job at a spin-dry, 30-day kind of deal. And I find that the psychological information kind of approach to things is being, you know, it doesn't sound like that's what you guys are up to, but it seems to me that, you know, information, you know, this is your brain on alcohol, this is your brain on drugs, this is your brain, this is your brain, this is your brain. Bill Wilson said that self-knowledge really didn't solve the problem. Alcoholics Anonymous is transformational in its approach. I guess I would like to know, how are you guys bringing that transformational thing to the academic world, or is anybody sort of avant-garde when it comes to that kind of thing in the academic world? So, thank you.
Good question.
had I been able to continue in my verbosity, I was going to get to motivational interviewing, which I'm glad I didn't. So actually, there's a great deal of research which actually started in 1964 when the Surgeon General announced that cigarette smoking caused lung cancer, and there was a naive expectation that within 24 hours, everybody in the United States was going to stop smoking. He used media, and this was in the era that John Kennedy had just won the presidency based on media, then they began to fund research at NIH, at first it wasn't called motivational interviewing. The first group were Prochaska and DiClemente, and they called it stages of readiness to change, that only one in five people was ready to do anything at any point in time at an office visit. But the other comment I just wanted to make is that the 28-day thing, I mean, information is, you know, could be of some use. Part of the problem is when they show you your brain on alcohol and your brain on drugs, they don't have to show you because you got it. And in those first 28 days, there's actually research data that people don't actually retain too much of the well-meaning information. The information may not be that useful, and nobody learns it anyway, so I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
Thanks, Dr. Schwartz. And that was our higher power intervening on your speech. And that's what he was saying is it's into action, and I think that's what most programs try to do, engage you and get you into action. Next comment.
Yes, I'm Lou, an alcoholic. First of all, I just want to thank you for being friends of AA, and secondly, thank you for passing on to your students and your new colleagues to keep the message going. I'm retired military, and I got caught up in a transition. The military used to tolerate us going out and getting drunk and getting in fights. Well, I had 17 years, and the military stopped tolerating alcoholics. I was in the Army, but I was stationed in a Navy town on recruiting duty, so I was fortunate enough to get sent to the six-week Naval in-house treatment program, which was the model for the other services to follow. I was there for 8 weeks, so that tells you how sick I was. It was a sick. But my counselor, my goal was to be able to tolerate the military for the last 3 years, to get my retirement truck, to go out buy a trailer, and just drink myself to death. That was my goal. But on my outtake interview, Bob Kuhl, who was in the Navy, was a counselor, he told me that treatment was discovery and AA was recovery, and if I didn't get out and get into AA, that I was going to kill myself or some other people. And for that, I am truly grateful. So thank you.
My name is Denny. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety birthday is 12/12/1983. My home group is the St. Thomas group, which meets at St. Paul's Church. I'm home. Dr. Schwartz, I commend you for a quality that I still aspire to, and that quality is humility. I thank you for that, and I will take some of that with me today. As I said, I still aspire to that. And Andrea, I commend you for your courage in challenging a credentialed physician to stay within the time limitations of his presentation.
Not like an alcoholic to take charge, right?
Myers-Briggs diagnosed me with INTJ. Is there anything I can do to change that? The thing that I would really like to ask is, Bill Wilson said that this is alcoholism is a soul sickness. There is a person in my home group, a chemist who worked at the National Institute of Health, also very highly educated, who said at a meeting one time that he believes that on some level we chose this disease. And Bill Wilson alludes to that in some of his letters, that we have the power of choice. Now, what is your take on that? I'm asking you, Dr. Schwartz, that you may be able to take certain liberties here with your personal opinion that you would not be able to take, say, in a more scientifically or medically oriented community, that the soul may actually have some choice because of the lessons we need to learn in this lifetime.
Because I'll put on my psychiatric hat a little bit. We face a real problem in kind of therapies. By the way, I think AA is one of the more potent therapies. I think if my patients actually have alcoholism plus some psychiatric problem, since we know CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is head-to-head as good as good or better than medication, what better place to get the whole thing solved than AA? But in any case, so the problem we face in therapy, because it isn't about getting medicine from somebody else, it's about some other kind of process, is that the implication is that you can do the work and you know you can heal yourself. So the tension is to look forward, not backward. Because if you look backward, then you say you kick yourself because it's my fault, and I should have changed it 10 years ago. That's very unproductive. So that's kind of an intellectual juggle act of trying to focus on in a forward direction. I think it is a dilemma that if you can change something, then why do you have it, and why didn't you do it before? I don't like to blame victims. I think we are powerless, and that there's some kind of blend of powerless and regaining power. But you raised some very critical issues.
My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also terrified. I came to this program about 42 years ago, and I wore two hats for about 25 years. And they don't say that anymore. They don't talk about wearing two hats, but I was in the military, I was in the Navy, and I was given an opportunity to go work in an alcohol clinic for the Canadian government. And I was given that job because I was in AA, and I happened to be a sailor. And they offered me the job, and I took it, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. But when I got out of the Navy, I got out of the Navy in 1978, I was offered a job a little while later with the provincial government, and I am a Canadian, and I'm a very proud Canadian. But I'm a little bit worried about Canada right now, because when I went to work for the provincial government, and I'm not going to say what province I come from, but it's on my card, and I know it, is that to be a member of AA was an asset. It was a big asset to get into the field of addictions. I retired about 11 or 12 years ago, and it wasn't an asset anymore. It was a liability. The professionals, I mean, we're supposed to have global, or what do they call that, health plan from across the whole country. And it seems to me, I mean, that down in the East Coast, we're getting ripped because they don't want AA anymore, or they seem not to. We have detoxes in the province that I live in. They lock them up. They won't even let them go to a meeting. They'll no longer let AA go onto the facility and take them out to a meeting at night. They won't let them do that anymore. And it's a shame. It's a shame. I mean, AA wants to go inside, but for some reason or other, some of their professionals don't want us there at all. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Cassie. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and this fellowship, I have approximately 20 months sober. I was one of those high school students that was too busy doing other activities instead of going to class and doing what I was supposed to be doing. At the age of 40, I've just been accepted into the freshman class at a local university. About 2 years ago, I had to choose sobriety over my marriage. So I found myself a high school dropout with a small child, no education, no real job skills, on my own. Pardon the pun, but that was a very sobering fact. So I did what I had to do, got myself cleaned up, and I've been working the best damn program in southern Oklahoma. I think and believe that my higher power is telling me to go into the recovery field. Because I do like people. God knows I understand them. The ones who are as sick as I am. And my question is, what would be the best course for me to take to achieve that?
Thank you.
Well, congratulations, and I think you're an asset for the Oklahoma Recovery Program.
Thank you.
As far as looking into this as a field, you know, talking about it, and first of all, it sounds like your recovery is solid and strong, and that is the kind of people that oftentimes are an incredible asset to the treatment field. So that's wonderful, and I wish you well with that. There are several programs for becoming certified, but also the credentials oftentimes are needed in terms of going into social work, counseling, sometimes psychology. And so starting out with some of the local certification-oriented classes can be helpful, but people get into the addictions field from any number of specialty credentials. So starting with even a community college or a state college and trying to get some of that information about where you want to get to with the goal. It is difficult, I think, sometimes to get in as a volunteer in some of the treatment programs other than as an AA volunteer. But talking to the professionals in your local community can help also. But I think you start anywhere, and the programs, obviously, we've been talking about some of the funding cuts and some of the difficulties in getting care no matter where you are, and that's difficult. We're in an economy now where that can be hard. So I don't have a clear answer for you except to go for it and to know that the credentials are the baseline. Social work tends to look at a master's level for an independent provider, but we have a number of substance abuse counselors that work at Andrews Air Force Base and in other areas where it's the certification and a college degree that helps you get in the door.
Right.
And then working with a mentor, both in your recovery as well as in the field.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm James. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, thank you so much. It's great to know that we have people like you, friends of AA, being professionals and passing that on to students as well, because I think it's incredibly important. A little bit about myself. I'm a master's of social work student, also in a university in the East. I'll leave them unnamed. But and to answer the past lady's question, I mean, basically, you know, community college is great to get all those prereqs out of the way, and then. But I mean, I always tell people to first meet with an advisor in the program you want to end up in, you know, and they'll be able to tell you what all you need to do. Anyway, I also appreciate this gentleman's comment here because, and it's a little unfortunate that maybe y'all have to kind of come in here and hear maybe some of the concerns that people have about professionals, and I think that there's a lot of friends of AA in the professional and academic realm. But just in my short experience, I gotta tell you, I've been like a little kind of surprised of still the lack of understanding and empathy that's out there toward AA. And actually, I've kind of received the message of like, okay, we're gonna let you into our professional world as a treatment provider, but we really want you to distance your identity as being a member of AA. And maybe it's a bit of the pink elephant that's in the room, I think, for me. It's just I guess really what I've noticed too in the couple of meetings that I've been to in talking about this is that just the lack of a member of AA as a professional. That's to no fault to anybody here. Everyone just graciously sort of accepted their invitation to come and speak. But I know for me, I would have been interested to hear about that transition for somebody. But I'm really nervous, as y'all might be able to tell. So I guess it's a question, and especially, Sue, I would love to talk to you later, too, because I recently interviewed to work with the military population as an intern. But my question would be, have you also encountered this sort of prejudice toward AA in your professions, and what sort of advice do you have to me as a member also trying to get into the treatment field? Thank you.
I'm going to ask Sue to answer the question and then ask that no one else line up at the mic because we're not going to get through everyone, but we will get through all of those of you who are there if you hold your comment and response to about 2 minutes each.
I have several reactions to your comments. I appreciate them. One is the process, again, looking at things in terms of a process of change for the teamwork between the profession and the therapists and members of AA, and it is difficult. It is difficult to bridge that gap. In the military, I think there's a clear advocacy toward people in recovery getting into the professional world. I think the Navy has really led us through over the years, because Navy counselors have often been the primary treatment providers for individuals in the military, and they've really espoused that the certification program for addictions counselors have really preferred and have focused in on people who are in recovery themselves. I want to say also that there's an identity issue for, I think, therapists that want to fix people, that feel like they want to be the expert, they want to know something, that can be in conflict with AA and that experience, that personal living through the changes. And so I think that the idea that we're coming together and moving forward is wonderful, but we have a long ways to go. So I hear you, and I think it will be a true asset for you depending on where you go to work. And when you find an organization that views AA as a deficit as opposed to a true asset, then that education process may take a little longer. But I hope you speak up. And I think you'll see that there are a number of clinics and a number of job opportunities where that will be truly appreciated. So good luck. And I do hope we can talk after the session if you want.
Hi, my name is Leah. I'm an alcoholic. And this is my first convention, but this month, God willing, the middle of this month, I'll be celebrating 23 years. And I've been a nurse for 27 years, and but just recently, in the last few years, started working in this field. I work in a detox and rehab, and I went back to school. Also, I'm in a psychiatric nurse practitioner program, and this is exactly what I want to do. But it's funny. The reason that I came to this talk was because it is odd having these different hats and knowing, you know, where I am and what my identity is. And it's funny when I'm sitting talking to patients and I'm talking just like a nurse, you know, they're listening sort of, I can tell halfway. And but the second, like, I have my sober date on a bracelet. Sometimes I'll show them, I'll say, see that, you know what that is? And all of a sudden they're listening differently. And I had a thought. I have no tattoos, and my husband can't stand tattoos, but I actually had a thought when I got this bracelet that I wanted a tiny date of my sober date. And then I thought to myself, how dare I assume that that is my permanent sober date? It seemed like a profound lack of humility and kind of jinxy. So it's on my bracelet. But it's funny what that first man said, because that's exactly what I was going to get up here and say. And I'm sure that at some level, at some point, something planted the seed about that. But I always tell my patients this. I had this thought, because I can't stand being forced to do something, but if it was my idea, then I'm okay with it. I had this thought that before I was born, somehow God came to me and said, I have something that I need you to help me with, and it's up to you. You can say yes or no, but I have some people that are sick. But the one thing you're going to have to know if you say yes is I'm going to have to give you the same disease first, or you're not going to be able to help them. And I feel like I said yes. And that, like, I listened to the speaker, and he says drug addiction and alcoholism is the only disease that once you get treatment for it, you're left in better shape than before you got it. And that is so true for me. And the last thing I'll say is I had to do a paper for school last semester, and we could pick anything, and I picked resilience as a topic. And something I found out that I never knew, I've had a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress in the past. There is actually something, a real thing, called post-traumatic growth. And the difference is adverse with resilience, you're able to bounce back to previous levels of functioning. With post-traumatic growth, as a result of the adversity, you actually become more able and better to deal with life. And they use this example of the Chinese symbol for crisis. When it's translated, I should get that as a tattoo, actually. That's what I just thought of. But when it's translated, it translates into danger and opportunity. And that's what I just feel like this has been. And I'm just so grateful to be here. Thank you.
My name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. My last 15 years, I'm retired Air Force. My last 15 years I spent as a substance abuse counselor with the Social Actions Program, where I received my initial certification. When I first reached San Antonio, somebody took me to my first AA meeting at my lunch hour. And one of my coworkers said, Tony, you went to a meeting in your uniform? And I said, well, I got drunk in my uniform. And, so what was the big deal? But I'm glad to see that the Air Force is still going on with their programs. And I also spent almost 14 years working at the VA hospital here in San Antonio as a counselor. I still do volunteer work. One of the reasons we used to take people to meetings, but they stopped that because the word God was mentioned. And they said we can't force people, we couldn't force people to go to meetings. They can volunteer to go. So that was part of that. And then I read, in fact, I saw on TV where a judge wouldn't make a lady go to a meeting because she said they made him pray. Of course, we know better than that, but I mean, that's prayer is optional. But one of the courts said, well, you can't force people to go to AA because they make them pray. So, but you know, in the foxholes, you pray a lot sometimes, you know. and of course, in the morning after, I used to pray, say, oh, man, you know, I don't want to do this again. And by 5 o'clock, I would be off and running, you know. But thank you. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
My name is Chuck. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm also a social worker. So hats off to my colleagues. I'm also an educator. And through the grace of God, of my understanding, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll be celebrating 20 years next month. And I think it's a fine line between, I was thinking about, you know, many are called, few are chosen. I'm fortunate, I'm blessed, you know, we're offered a life beyond our wildest dreams. I was offered an opportunity, 5 years sober, to work in a rehab on the adolescent unit, and without giving the name of the place, but with the idea was we're just planting seeds, you know, and I think that that's the common denominator with social work, too, and with AA. It's like we don't always see the fruit of our labor, you know, and that's kind of like a spiritual thing that we have to kind of trust in the process and have faith that, you know, everyone's got a higher power and I'm not it. I would just say it's like just work on your sobriety first and foremost, and it's like the idea of it's called how do you do it? It's like boundaries. And it's called compartmentalization. It's just like, and it's refreshing to come here and talk about this because, you know, we can't talk about this in AA. And the gentleman mentioned about the two-hat meetings, and there was a two-hat meeting where I got sober. And maybe I was thinking maybe I should start one in my community because it really is needed. And I would just say that because to come here and talk with like-minded people about, I think there has to be a distinction between AA and treatment and that there is a mutual relationship there. And people are surprised when... And it was great because we were talking about this in our seventh tradition meeting last week in my home group. And I said, you know, going to the World Conference, this is my third World Conference, how non-alcoholic friends of AA have really been instrumental in the growth and development of our program. And it was just wonderful last night when the chair got up and it's like non-alcoholic. So it's like we need the help. Because when I go to a meeting, it's like when I go to an AA meeting and I'm an alcoholic, I'm a recovering alcoholic. When I'm doing substance abuse counselor, I'm a counselor, but you have to have the education. And it's like I can't let my... personal experience that really, and the other idea is the therapeutic use of self. But anyway, and the last thing to say is too, is my job is to shed light, not to master, you know, and I just say it's just wonderful to have this dialogue, to come here and have this discussion with like-minded people and sensibilities orientation, because I think there's a lot of confusion that, you know, there's an accurate say, oh, well, AA is not treatment and we can't have, you know, any relationship with professionals, and that's, I think, misleading. And it's great to see so many of you here because I was a few minutes late. I had gone to the meeting, or the room next door, and there was about 10 people there. And I said, oh, man, I was so disappointed. It's like, this is the meeting. Thank you.
All right. We are going over, and I see people coming in. If you're coming in, you have to take a seat. Fire marshal will not allow you to stand. If you don't want to take a seat, you can go back outside on the other side of the door. And I really have to urge our last speakers to keep it to 2 minutes because we are over now, and they're going to have to turn the room over. But out of respect that you've stood there so patiently, we want to hear from you. But if you can hold your comments to 2 minutes, be great.
Great. Hi, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. And I just real briefly, I even also in the addiction feel like I got in late in life and did my internship at NIH, which was fabulous. I guess my only comment was I got my first job, and it was at a residential inpatient for teenage girls, ages 13 to 17. And I lasted 5 weeks because of lack of staffing. And, you know, I guess that's my frustration. I mean, I learned a lot from this, and I'm wondering if – I'm also was not allowed to break my anonymity. You know, and that I struggled with that a little bit. So, you know, actually not even a question but a comment is hopefully that the lack of staffing – you know, these kids were not getting even the seed planted. They were just being housed, which was very, very frustrating to me. And so I got out of that field and realized there was a reason I didn't have kids. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dick Kessler. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dick.
I'm also president of the National, American Society on Alcoholism and ADPA, the Alcohol and Drug Problems Association in North America. And I want to thank you guys, because without you, there would be no Alcoholics Anonymous. Without the people like Silkworth and all of our good friends that were not alcoholic, we would not be here today. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. But I want to say real quickly two things. I've been in this business for 40 years. I've run every kind of program there is to run, inpatient, outpatient, free, no matter. And the one thing that concerns me as much as anybody, people say, well, I've been sober now 6 months. I want to be a counselor. And, I mean, that's all right if you want to go to school and stuff. But don't come and tell me you're doing your 12-step work. I'm here. This is my living. This is my sobriety. And you got to keep that separate. Do not ever think you're going to be able to mix them two and stay sober. The other thing, very quick, I say there's some really good schools going on now in the country I'm on the board at the University of Wisconsin-Menominee, where we get a nice grant from the Gates Foundation in Florida to train medical students. And we get about 75 to 80 medical students and a whole bunch of nurses and stuff, and they're taught by addictionologists. And the University of Utah does the same thing. So I really think that the education in the medical field is improving so much to where it was a few years ago. You know, we went through the decriminalization back in the 70s with help of Senator Hughes and all that. Then we got back into recriminalization some way or another, and I think we're starting to see some of that go away now, and I hope so. Again, thank you very much. Appreciate your help.
Thanks, Dick. Hi, I'm Beth, alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
And I was fortunate enough to get sober at a relatively young age. And I went back and got a biology degree, and I now teach biology and human anatomy and phys. And as a result of my life experience, I teach a unit on addiction within that. And it is, I share a little bit of my experience, not that I'm alcoholic, but coming from an alcoholic family. And I teach in a community where there's a huge percentage of alcoholism in the families of the children I teach. So I do a lot of that seed planting. And I wanted to say, thank you so much to all of you, and specifically to Dr. Schwartz. Having had the experience a few years ago of witnessing my father die a very traumatic, horrible alcoholic death, that there's palliative care for cancer and all of these other treatable diseases, but there is a point at which we stop treating cancer and other things. And I know we would all like to think it's never too late with alcoholism, but there is a point at which it is too late. And there was no palliative care. There was no understanding of alcoholism. And he died in the VA. Well, he was moved from the VA, but... And it was traumatic for my brother and I, who's also sober and in the medical field, and for my father. I mean, it was horrific, you know. And I just wanted to express my extreme gratitude for the work that all of you do and say how important it is for medical doctors to be educated about alcoholism. So thank you very much.
I want to ask you to join me again in thanking our speakers.